Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Tommy Michaud. He was born and raised in South Louisiana. He's of Acadian descent and hence is a Cajun. He worked for 30 years as a research biologist and pilot for the U.S. Department of the Interior and is now in the graduate faculty of the University of Louisiana, where he serves as a research scientist for the Institute for Coastal Ecology and Engineering. He spent his career studying wetland flora and fauna, primarily in the coastal marshes of Louisiana and the Gulf of Mexico coast from Florida to Texas and Mexico and the Caribbean coast of Guatemala and Honduras. So thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program.
Well, you're welcome, Derek, and it's great to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Oh, thanks. And so let's start by what are the coastal marshes of Louisiana, and why are they important to you, and why are they important to the world?
Okay, very good. The coastal marshes of Louisiana, there is a band of coastal wetlands in Louisiana that run from the Gulf of Mexico inland about 50 miles on the average, but it varies and depending on the gradient of the landscape and the elevation. So they start at 0 degrees above sea level, which is, 0 feet. They start at sea level and go up several feet to the area where what we call uplands start, which are areas that don't flood frequently. And whereas the wetlands are composed of plants that are adapted to being flooded under at least a portion of their lives, if not their whole lives. And the our wetlands then are very productive. There are square miles. They're very extensive. There's about 14,000 square kilometers, if that means anything, of wetlands in our coastal zone. Out of maybe 40,000 square kilometers, almost half of those are wetlands, and there's some, maybe 5,000 square kilometers of non-wetland, and the rest is water. About the other half would be water, open water. Now, that ratio is gradually changing over time so that there's more water, more and more water every year due to the loss of wetlands, and that's the issue that we're talking about here. When we say marsh loss or land loss or wetland loss, we're talking about primarily about the conversion of wetlands to open water, although they can be converted to other things such as upland. But primarily, it's the loss of marsh, which is a grassland that's either totally permanently flooded or maybe semi-permanently flooded or tidally flooded through the tides that go up and down every day. So, and when those grasses are no longer a solid sea of green grass, similar to the prairie that you would have in the Midwestern United States, in Kansas, for instance, you might see miles and miles of prairie grasses back in the old days before it was farmed. And in a similar way, you'd see miles and miles of marsh grasses down here. But over time, then that has changed into more and more open water, either small open water areas or larger open water areas that exist down here. And that's the issue of land loss that we're dealing with. And those marshes support a myriad of fauna, and especially animals and plants that are very valuable and, useful to humans as a food item, for one thing, and for recreational fishing and for commercial fishing and hunting and different uses in the human sociology. From 1932 to 2010, the latest studies show that we've lost, we're losing about 69 square kilometers per year of wetlands in our coastal marshes, about 1.5 football fields per hour. That's the going rate of wetland loss. And so this is is of concern to the people down here, because there's a lot of people, for one thing, that have their livelihood from the marshes of Louisiana. They're full of shrimp. They have oysters and crabs and speckled trout and redfish and oysters, and people like harvesting those. When the Acadians first arrived here back in the mid-1700s, after we were expelled from what's now Nova Scotia by the English, they put us on ships and sent us off to other English colonies, and a lot of us ended up here in Louisiana. Word got around to all our cousins that, hey, we got a paradise in Louisiana. And so a lot of the Acadians ended up here. And they really took to the wetlands, because the Acadians were really seafaring people and fishers, and were used to hunting and fishing and living off the land and trapping. And those were all activities that they could do down here and also maintain their French culture and their strong community spirit, and with very minimum of interference from the people that we call les Américains, the Americans. And so the French Cajuns were French speaking and had a very strong community bond of helping each other, and they were able to live in more or less isolation and continue the French language because of our wetlands. Nobody else really wanted to go out in the wetlands. They were too busy making a living on the higher ground, so we took to the wetlands and made a way of life out there. Now, a little bit about the coast of Louisiana's contribution, its importance. It is important to the humans in a lot of ways. Crude oil, for instance, a big portion of the crude oil in the United States comes from the Gulf of Mexico and is enters the mainstream through facilities in coastal Louisiana. And there's drilling in the marshes themselves, in addition to out in the Gulf. And all that oil is pumped into pipelines or shipped to different ports throughout the world through Louisiana, and a lot of the natural gas as well. And a big chunk of the commercial fisheries, for instance, menhaden and shrimp, and then a lot of the waterborne commerce. I have numbers on all that, like 21%, 30% of the national commerce in different things, but mainly because of the, a lot of it is because of the oil and gas resources, and a lot of it is because of our seafood resources, that these marshes are very productive, and they are able to produce a lot of organisms. And then a lot of it is also because of the Mississippi River and it being the base of waterborne inland commerce, transportation in North America. Is the largest stream in North America, the largest river, and the fourth largest river in the world. And so that, because of that, a lot of ships come through the Mississippi River system, enter it in Louisiana from the Gulf of Mexico, ocean-going vessels, and they maybe download their cargo onto riverine transportation vessels, and or to trains and trucks, and they end up going all over the United States. And it also connects with the upper Mississippi, which is connected with the Great Lakes and up into Canada. So the Mississippi River system is very important, but the coastal marshes of Louisiana are important to us and to a way of life that we have basically evolved with over the last several hundred years. And the Mississippi River system actually drains about 41% of the continental United States, the 48 contiguous states, about part of 31 states and two Canadian provinces. But the marshes are just great for most of the local people down here. Everybody either owns a boat or has access to one, or just goes out in the marsh on their own to go fishing or crabbing, like to a lot of the state or federal wildlife refuges that exist down here, Rockefeller, Sabine, Lacassine National Wildlife Refuge, and the Atchafalaya Basin, very important recreational hunting and fishing areas.
So I'm one. Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, I've read some pretty extraordinary accounts of what the natural world was like from early European explorers' perspective on the number of birds and number of fish. Can you talk about a little bit about what, in your research, what the area was like prior to conquest? It's like in the Northwest, you've heard there are so many stories of runs of salmon so large that you could hear them literally for miles before you'd see them. And I know in 1932 in Canada, there was a single run of salmon that I believe it went on for 30 days, and out in the ocean it was still 12 miles wide before it funneled in.
Wow.
You know, just, and I know that in the northeastern United States, or off the coast, that the whales were so thick that it would look like it was foggy from their breath.
Wow.
And in California, in the San Francisco Bay, early European explorers said that it looked like the bay was, quote, paved, end quote, with sea lions. So do you know accounts like that from the lower Mississippi and from the marshlands of just the birds or fish or anything? Can you talk to that at all?
Well, yes, we do have accounts of, say, for instance, passenger pigeons and Carolina parakeets. Audubon, some of the reports of John James Audubon and others from several hundred years ago reported that sometimes the flocks would pass overhead for days containing millions of individuals. They would start flying overhead and just keep flying, and people started hunting them and shooting them, just having a pigeon shoot. And that was really a big part of what contributed to their demise. The passenger pigeon is now extinct and has been since 1914. In fact, the last passenger pigeon in existence was one named Martha, was in captivity in the Cincinnati Zoo. It was a female that died on September 1st, 1914. This is one of the few, or maybe the only, instance of a species going extinct where we knew the exact date and time of the species passing, because that was the last one. And it was a female, and there was no male to breed with, so we knew that it was the last one. But there was nothing anybody could do. But they were over-harvested, similar to the overfishing of the great cod fisheries in western North Atlantic, and which resulted in closure of the cod fisheries in the 1990s, I guess. But there was a lot of market hunting of the passenger pigeons, and it led to their demise. Now, another one was the Carolina parakeet was also very numerous throughout the southeastern United States. The passenger pigeon was as well. Passenger pigeon actually was all over eastern United States and southeastern Canada. And the Carolina parakeet was almost as great of a distribution, but a little further south. It went up to almost to the Great Lakes, but it didn't go beyond north of there, but it was all over southeastern United States. And it was actually extinct in 1918, so not long after the passenger pigeon, around that same time. And they had they would form large, noisy flocks that would feed on cultivated fruit, and like they really did a lot of damage to the apple trees and trying to get to the seeds, and they would eat corn and other grain crops, and it was considered a serious agricultural pest in the 1800s and early 1900s, and they were killed in huge numbers by farmers and that in combination with the destruction of forests in the range of the Carolina parakeet, the bottomland hardwood forests of the eastern southeastern United States, really contributed to its demise as well, and the loss of nesting habitat. And the feathers, the bright feathers, were used in the millinery trade for women's hats. You know, around the turn of the 19th and 20th century, hats were a big fashion item for women, and a lot of them were made with feathers from birds. And so these, like the Carolina parakeet, for instance, and also species like herons and egrets, were highly used for the millinery trade, and those heron and egret populations also took a nosedive and were almost exterminated. But the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of the early 1900s was actually enacted, and they used a treaty with Mexico and Canada, which allowed the federal government to step in and make rules concerning the take of wildlife species, because they were migratory and it happened to be tied in with treaties. And that's how they were able to start the game laws for birds, and then it led to our current extensive legal system for protecting birds, primarily migratory birds. So traditionally, the federal government protects migratory birds, and whereas the state governments usually have jurisdiction for non-migratory species or resident species that stay in the state, and that so that comes under the regulation of the state governments. But the species like the passenger pigeon and the Carolina parakeet were basically pushed to extinction, and also other species like the Labrador duck, for instance, and the dodo bird in the Indian Ocean were also pushed to extinction. But some species like all the egrets and herons, the snowy egret, for instance, the great egret, the Louisiana heron or tricolored heron, all those are species that were brought back, roseate spoonbills, and those are doing fine now. And because of the laws and the protection that was afforded to them. And then there are species like the brown pelican that were actually extirpated in Louisiana in the 1960s due to pesticide poisoning from DDT and other organochlorines prior to them being outlawed. But in fact, the book by Rachel Carson, Silent Spring, in the 1960s, really opened up everybody's eyes to what was happening with our birds, and we were spraying, like Joni Mitchell said, gimme bugs on my apple, but take away the DDT or something like that. Oh, but leave me the birds and the bees. So I tell my students that about Joni Mitchell and about Rachel Carson and what they did to kind of bring on the environmental movement of the 1960s and 70s and increase environmental awareness, which led to a lot of pieces of legislation that ended up saving a lot of wildlife species, including the Endangered Species Act, and also the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act and the Environmental Policy Act, National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act. All of those were enacted around that time, the early 70s. So they all came out of the environmental movement. So a lot of good things came out of our generation, I might say that.
So you said earlier that there was a football field and a half of marsh being lost there every hour. Okay, so how is the marshland losing? What is happening, and what has been happening to cause the marsh? And I know that we started to talk about this before, but I screwed up and did not have the recorder on. So could you say again how so much of that marsh is being lost, and then after saying how it's being lost, why and especially from a biocentric perspective, why should anybody care that the marshlands are being lost?
Okay, well, those are good questions. And the for one thing, I mean, the causes of wetland loss in Louisiana are very diverse, and we, you know, we think we understand it, but we're still learning new things. But there are several major issues. One is the levying of the Mississippi River, and I can talk about each of these, but that's one. Another one is just the construction of canals in general in the marsh, and another one is subsidence and sea level rise, which in combination we call relative sea level rise, which also stems from global warming and global climate change that is associated with the burning of fossil fuels and the changes in the ozone layer and the greenhouse effect and the warming of the Earth's atmosphere and the melting of the polar ice cap. So all that leads to higher sea levels. And also around here, our land is sinking, and it turns out it's always been sinking. We call it subsidence. It subsides, and due to a lot of things, the sediments compact over time. They get closer. The grains get closer together. As plants die, they become part of the sediment, but that's highly organic, and so there's a mixture of the organic and the mineral sediments. And for instance, if people put a levee around an area of marsh. In the old days, like in the 1930s, a lot of land companies from the Midwestern United States, for instance, and from further north, came down here and formed corporations and bought out a lot of the marshland, thinking they could put levees around it, pump it out, and then convert it to agricultural use or perhaps recreational use or residential. And they started doing that, but what they found out was once you take the water off of that land, the soil starts compacting and dropping in elevation, and so the soil elevation gets lower and lower, and it becomes harder and harder to pump it out because you got to pump harder and harder, pump more and more, more pumping effort, and then there becomes more of a head differential between the water outside the levee and the water inside the levee that you're trying to pump off. And so it gets harder and harder to keep it dry. And then eventually the levee will break or just you can't keep up, the pumps aren't strong enough or there's not enough electricity, and they'll end up having to let it go and it fills up with water again. And there are several areas like that in South Louisiana that are just these large rectangles of open water that were farmed in that manner. So, but the combination of subsidence and sea level rise is one thing that results in our marshes being flooded more. And there's the plants can take being flooded to a certain extent, but there is a point beyond which the plants start losing their vitality, and they can actually die because of the basically being waterlogged, we call it, but it changes the chemical respiration and the things that go on in the root zone of the plants and the conversion of chemicals from one form to another, and they change from what we call aerobic to anaerobic respiration, and there are metal toxicities that with aluminum or zinc or iron or different elements that are in the sediment that could eventually cause these plants to die, or the plants just can't survive being flooded, inundated for that long of a period of time. They like, in general, plants like this periodic watering and dewatering. The flooding and dewatering of the marsh is what gives it its vitality. That's the tidal cycle every day being flooded, and then the marsh is also populated with aquatic organisms, invertebrates, snails and shells and crabs and crustaceans and roundworms and all kind of things that move in with the water, fishes that swim around and feed on the area that was dry during low tide, and now it's wet and inundated and accessible to many species of marine organisms. And then when the tide goes out, everybody goes back to the bigger channels and the deeper waters that the fishes do, and then the soil becomes aerated and the plants switch to aerobic respiration, and they do fine under those conditions. But when you keep it flooded all the time and the period that it's dewatered becomes less frequent or non-existent, then the plants start doing not as well, and they become unhealthy, and they eventually die. And then the area, that's one way in which the marshes can be converted to open water. So open water is not bad when it's surrounded by a lot of marsh, but the marsh is where the productivity is of all these organisms. That's where all the action is with the shrimp and the crabs and the fishes. And there, scientists such as myself and my colleagues have done a lot of studies looking at, for instance, edge effect, where they take these traps, like a cylindrical fiberglass tank with no bottom and no top, just a circle that they carry on a winch of a boat and then drop it in the marsh, so it drops so fast that any organisms that are inside that circle get trapped in there. It's like maybe a meter or a meter and a half in diameter. And then then they pump the water out and remove all the organisms, all the fishes and shrimp and crabs from inside that circle. And that's one method to survey and quantify the number of organisms in a certain volume of water. And so they've done repeated sampling like this close to the edge and then farther and farther away from the edge on the marsh side and on the open water side. And they found that there's a huge spike in activity in organisms near the edge. And so these are all factors that determine how productive the coastal marshes are. But when it converts to all open water and very little land in there, then there's no edge, and the grasses, that's where all the life starts, is from the primary producers. So the vegetation is what starts the bottom of the food chain and the food web. And then those that nutrition is passed on to all the other trophic levels as it moves through the communities of small organisms to larger organisms. But anyway, and then the humans are on the top end of that, harvesting these shrimp and crabs and eating them. And people down here like to eat and drink beer and have a good time. That's part of what it's all about. But but there's things like that. The construction of canals has taken its toll on our marshes. For one thing, when they dig a canal, the soil that's removed has to be placed somewhere, so they put it on the side of the canal. Otherwise, you'd have to boat it off or ship it off with a barge. That would be too expensive, cost prohibitive. But they're not building so many canals now, but for a while, like in the 60s and 50s, 60s, 70s, they were building a lot. Now they're more highly regulated because of those laws I told you, the Environmental Policy Act, for instance, and others. But a lot of these canals were built for several reasons. One is flood control, and another one is navigation. Flood control is mainly the building of levees, but they use the canals for what they call borrow areas or borrow ditches, to borrow the soil from to place it on the levee. So that's one. And another one is navigation. Like, there's some huge navigation canals that were built for inland shipping. The Gulf Intercoastal Waterway, for instance, it runs east-west and parallel to the coast of the Gulf of Mexico from Florida all the way down to Brownsville, Texas. And then also it runs up the Atlantic coast too, the Atlantic Intercoastal Waterway. But then perpendicular to that channel and perpendicular to the Gulf coastline, or several other navigation channels, shipping channels that connect the inland ports with the Gulf of Mexico, such as there's a Sabine ship channel over on the Texas-Louisiana border, then the Calcasieu ship channel, and then there's the Houma Navigation Canal that goes up to Houma, and the Barataria Waterway south of New Orleans. So all of these channels run north and south, and in addition to serving as a conduit for shipping, they also serve as a conduit for salt water moving up into the estuary higher than it did before. So this salinity change is bad for a lot of the vegetation. The vegetation that's on the high end of the hydrologic gradient is in fresher water, and it's those are freshwater plants, and they can't handle the salinity. So if it gets too salty, those plants will die. Sometimes they're replaced by plants that are used to living in higher salt, but a lot of times they'll just die and float away, and they won't have time for these saltier plants to establish themselves. So maybe the sediment will become unvegetated, and then it'll be washed away because there's nothing holding it together in the root zone. So that's what we call saltwater intrusion. So that's another one of the factors. So subsidence, sea level rise, the levee system of the Mississippi River, the levees associated with canals, hydrologic changes from canals, oil and gas development, saltwater intrusion. And then there's things like barrier island degradation, the loss of the barrier islands due to erosion and lack of sediment, and then storms such as hurricanes. Those are all factors that contribute to the loss of marsh in Louisiana's marshes. But why should people care? Well, they should care for a lot of reasons, and one of them is the fact that inland, the cities that are located farther inland, such as New Orleans, Lafayette, Houma, Lake Charles, those are fairly close to the Gulf of Mexico, and during hurricane season, they are vulnerable to the winds associated with the hurricanes that come across the Gulf. And these wetlands protect those areas, those centers, from the winds. In fact, it has been shown that there is a reduction in the force of the winds as they make landfall, and then the more marsh and wetlands between the coast and the city, then the better they are protected, and the more of a reduction in wind speed you'll get from a storm. And then when the barrier islands are out there, that's what we call the first line of defense, not only from the winds, but also from the waves and the storm surge. So I guess you could say these wetlands absorb the punch of hurricanes. And they also serve to help purify the water that is coming down from inland as rain runoff and other contributions of humankind to the water system, to the hydrology, is in terms of contaminants and nutrients that are all part of the waste stream of our society end up going downstream. And so a lot of this water, as the rivers flood and go into the wetlands, these plants will take up these nutrients, and they will serve to remove them from the water column and therefore purify, so to speak, the water. And that's another function of wetlands. But the wetlands also support many organisms. And as I said, the watering and dewatering of wetlands provides habitat for aquatic organisms as well as terrestrial organisms, depending on the cycle of the flood and the ebb and the tide. And so then there are a lot of species that use that are located in the oceans. They in their adult life, part of their life cycle, for instance, they might be out in the Gulf, whereas during their juvenile stage, they might come inland into the estuaries to use that as a nursery area to before the juveniles and larval stage to mature and get bigger and then get big enough to become breeding adults, and then they move out back out into the estuary, such as like white shrimp and brown shrimp do this, and crabs, and then a lot of fishery species will move in to the marshes and the estuaries, and when they're small, and feed in there on the many organisms there until they get bigger, and then they'll move back out into the oceans. But so that a lot of these are harvested in the water areas of the marsh as well as offshore in the Gulf of Mexico.
It seems with the loss of the marshlands, and it seems with the other changes too, that one of the things that is that strikes me whenever I think about what happens to forests or what happens to rivers because of dams is that the places evolved with incredibly rich and complex relationships that are far more complex, not only than we think they are, but than we're even capable of thinking. And so often, when you go in and make it, it stuns me that time and again in this culture, when you'll make a major change to a natural community, then you'll be surprised when the natural community starts to fall apart. It's like if you disallow the Mississippi River from flooding and depositing sediment into marshlands, then somehow we end up surprised when those marshlands degrade.
Yeah, true. And that's true. And you're right about things being unexpected or just something that we never dreamed of. That happens all the time, it seems like, when we mess with Mother Nature, you know. But, you know, as to why, I mean, you could theoretically just let it go. I mean, if, for one thing, we're stuck with the activities of man, which has caused or at least exacerbated a lot of these factors that have contributed to our marsh loss. And so on one hand, you can say, well, so what? What if we lose those wetlands? I mean, who's going to care? And why should they? So the answer to that is, I mean, for one thing, it's beautiful out there. It's a natural area. There's an aesthetic beauty to it and an aesthetic value that may not be able to be measured in terms of dollars and cents or food items or the economic development or oil and gas resource use. You know, all those things are nice and they contribute to our way of life and our society. But also there's a little slightly less tangible value that is placed on the marsh, that by humans just enjoying going out to the marsh and being able to sit there and just see all the animals with the birds flying around, catch a fish, cook it for supper, throw your cast net out and pull it in and get a load of shrimp and put them on to boil and then peel them and eat them, and paddle around in your pirogue out there in the marsh. I mean, all those things are aesthetically pleasing and they contribute to our well-being. So I think, you know, that's a huge part of it right there.
And then there's also simply, I mean, the lives of, you know, the grasses and the marsh and the white shrimp themselves. I mean, they are...
Yes, absolutely. They deserve to live as well. They're not our subservient species. They're species just like we are, and it's not up to us to determine, you know, whether we should let them live or not, or whether they should go extinct. It's wrong of us as a species to dominate other species if we're going to drive them to extinction or somehow harm them in some way. I mean, all species eat each other, and you know, everybody eats each other out there.
Right.
And that's going to happen. But it's not right for us to overpower other species and cause them to go extinct or to decimate their habitat so that they don't have a place to live or to nest or to feed or whatever, and to alter the landscape so much that all these species are in jeopardy. I mean, It's just ethically incorrect. It's ethically wrong.
And so, so you mentioned earlier something about restoring marshes. We've got about 6 or 7 minutes left, and I've got a couple final questions in a minute. But before we get to the final questions, can you talk about what is being done to attempt to either slow the rate of disappearing of the marsh of the marshes, or to talk about restoring marshes?
Yeah, sure. There's about a dozen or so activities, I would say, that are being used consistently, or at least talked about in our coastal wetlands to try to restore the marshes. I mean, one of the big ones is increasing the flow into the Atchafalaya River, which is the Atchafalaya River is the biggest distributary channel of the Mississippi, and it carries a big part of the flow of the Mississippi, but it's limited by law to only 30%, and that limitation is implemented by a control structure that was made by the Army Corps of Engineers up north of Baton Rouge, and it only allows 30% of the combined Mississippi and Red River flow to come down the Atchafalaya. Now, so one of the suggestions is to open that up and just let the river flow where it wants to flow, and that would be, most of it would then come down the Atchafalaya River. And because Atchafalaya Bay, where it empties into the Gulf and into the bay, is a large, shallow expanse of open water, but it's there are already two big deltas being formed in Atchafalaya Bay at the mouth of the Atchafalaya River. One's called the main Atchafalaya Delta, and the other one is called the Wax Lake Delta because it's a different outlet that comes down just west of the other one, but they're both within a few miles of each other. And there's a lot of rapid land building going on down there. That's really the only place on the Louisiana coast that is gaining land, is the Atchafalaya Delta. So a lot of people think, let the river flow where it wants to flow, and then you'll build that Atchafalaya Delta much faster, and therefore we'll build more marsh there, and that will counterbalance some of the losses we're having in other parts of the coastal zone. And that's true, too. So that's one. But that hasn't been done yet, but it's just being talked about. Another one is freshwater diversions and sediment diversions from the river. So this is in a similar manner to the Atchafalaya issue. There was an effort to try to duplicate or mimic the natural conditions. In other words, since the river would always overflow naturally before they built the levees, why not use the levees and water control structures to help the river water get carried into the coastal marshes at certain times in order to enhance marsh building? And that's to try to mimic the natural system, because right now the natural system has been interrupted by the levees of the Mississippi River. But if you open them up, and it's been shown that if you cut holes in the levee or put in a structure and allow the sediment to come, especially if it's a lot of sediment and it's carrying a lot of, or water is carrying a lot of sediment, that sediment will quickly settle out and form a small delta. And so that's another restoration feature. The fresh water diversion is letting diversions from the river occur, but at a smaller volume, not enough to carry sediments, but enough to carry fresh water, and that will keep the saltwater intrusion at bay. Another one is the construction of devices in the water to slow down the movement of water and let the sediments settle out, like Christmas tree fences. There was a big effort to have people recycle their Christmas trees after Christmas, and we'd put them along these fences, build two fences, and fill the inside with Christmas trees, and the fences would be like maybe 5 feet apart, about the length of a Christmas tree height, and you just fill them with Christmas trees, and as the water moves across an open water body, it would hit these Christmas trees, and it would slow down, and therefore the sediment would drop out, and that, theoretically, that's a way of building marsh. And they were successful to some extent, and they're still doing that in some places, but it's funding dependent and it's off and on. But that's one. Other things are terraces, the construction of levees in open water to try to build marsh and slow down the erosion. There's a marsh drawdown and hydrologic management using water control structures to try to encourage vegetation to grow by dropping the water down and having what they call a drawdown and allowing plants to germinate. And then as the plants get larger, then you let the water back in. So it's mimicking the natural system, but making sure that it's done in such a way as to enhance vegetation. They have shoreline protection devices, breakwaters, saltwater barriers, marsh and island creation using dredge material from offshore being pumped. Some of them are pumped from offshore into the barrier islands and spread out there to build more land. And other ones are pumped like for maintenance dredging for navigation channels. Since they have, as these channels fill in, the bottom comes up and they become shallower and too shallow for these big vessels to use. So instead of pumping the sediment out into just a disposal area, they put it so that it can build marsh. So it has to be put only up to a certain elevation. Then it settles, and the target elevation is right at or above marsh level, water level, maybe 6 inches at or below marsh level, so that it'll encourage the growth of these wetland plants. And another thing is planting vegetation on some of these newly created marshes. So these are all features and restoration efforts that are being tried and being done all along the coast and part of the Coastal Restoration Master Plan.
So I guess my last question is, if somebody listens to this and let's say they do live in the Gulf Coast, or if they don't live in the Gulf Coast, that's two different questions really, what can they do? And they care about coastal marshlands, what can they do?
Yeah, that's a tough one because there are a lot of things. It's kind of like on the local level, there are a lot of things people can do. It's kind of like reduce, reuse, recycle, part of the citizens' effort to make this world a greener and safer and happier place. But on the large front, it's to support coastal restoration activities, which are being conducted and constructed primarily with tax dollars. So, and occasionally those have to be voted on by either Congress or state representatives or senators or local governments or police juries or local officials, all the way up to federal officials. And one thing is to support politicians who hold office that are sympathetic to the plight of our Louisiana's wetlands, and to try to encourage those that will be willing to spend money to protect our wetlands and to restore those wetlands. I mean, that would be a big thing. But for the average citizen, I mean, there's not a whole lot you can do unless you want to volunteer to participate in some plantings and some restoration projects. We do have several organizations do conduct marsh plantings, like the Barataria Terrebonne National Estuary Program is one that has small youth groups and school groups go out and plant vegetation in areas that need it. And there are things like that, but they're kind of small on the larger scale of things. But there are things that citizens can do to try to encourage the restoration of our wetlands. But it's not, it's such a big, the issues are so big, and they're associated with huge structures and big policy decisions, that there's not a whole lot that the average citizen can do on a day-to-day basis that would change anything. But I think just supporting politicians who are aware of issues, of environmental issues, and try to vote for those people that want to reduce the footprint of humans on our world and on our environment, and support the legislation that moves us toward humans, towards being more in step with the rest of the natural world.
Well, that's great, and thank you for being on the program, and I would like to thank listeners very much for listening. My guest today has been Tommy Michaud. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.